well with young people in Britain today. That's pretty obvious when you look at the figures we have. If you look at the 1979 census of the churches carried out in England and Wales, for example, you find that the proportion of 15 to 19-year-olds in the church varies from denomination to denomination. Anglicans have about the same proportion that you find in the population at large. Nonconformists are below the target. And only Catholics have got more teenagers than the profile of the civil population might lead you to expect. And that's worrying for two reasons. First of all, it's at this stage of their lives that most people are more open and receptive to new ideals and answers to ultimate questions than they ever will be again. And so you'd expect more teenagers in the church than representatives of other age groups, even if they're only there temporarily, trying it on for size, as it were, before they decide against. And second, if you look at the figures for the next age group up, the age group 20 to 29, you find a sharp drop below the civil population proportion. And what that suggests is that there's a steady drain going on throughout the teenage years, that we lose as teenagers a tremendous number of the young people who have been in the church since their childhood. Now, when you look at the figures for Scotland from the later census in 1984, you find an even bleaker picture. 5% of the church in Scotland is aged 15 to 19, compared to 9% of the country's population. That's about half what you might expect to get, and an awful lot less than what you could get given the openness of teenagers. And when you look at the next age group up, and the next, you find the disparity in the figures growing. In other words, the dropout rate is even sharper than it is down south. Now, I think this unreality with which we've lived in the church has affected our attitude. Often we don't realise there is so much of a problem as there is. I did some work on the evangelical churches of my hometown, Swindon in Wiltshire, a few years ago, when people were claiming that the Mission England meetings had left us with a large number of enthusiastic new Christians and a new attitude towards Jesus amongst young people in our town. As a youth evangelist who worked a little bit in Swindon and saw one or two of the churches and what they were doing in youth work, I wasn't altogether sure that those generalisations were true. So I did a little bit of counting and I found some figures which persuaded me that there were something like 700 young people in our town who were involved with the church in activities through which they would hear the Christian message, youth groups, Bible classes, whatever. 700. And the youth population of the town is 25,679. There are 25,000 young people in Thamesdown, in Swindon, who are not hearing the gospel, who are not involved in the activities of any church. And that's a town in which we think we're doing rather well. Unreality. And I believe that getting it right with teenagers is one of the most important things that the church in this country has to do. Because teenagers are at a stage in life when they are making decisions about the future. Figures from counselling and crusades and evangelistic missions all around the world show that it's somewhere around 15 to 16 years of age that you'll get the majority of your converts. It's around that age that people, particularly in our Western culture, are deciding what they will believe, who they will be for the next 30, 40, maybe 50 years. And often there is not another window of openness in their lives until they reach, well, later on in middle age anyhow. It's at this age that they decide if they're going to be Christians or Marxists or Buddhists or just plain materialists like everybody else. And if we do not present the claims of Jesus Christ compellingly in a way they can understand at that point, the chances are we've missed him for good. And so we have to get it right with teenagers. And I think it's a difficult thing to do. Youth work is not an easy area of the church's involvement. I often say to youth workers that they have the most difficult job in the church. That's because they have a job which is, in one way, like children's work. It's very demanding. They're dependent on you. They absorb an awful lot of your time. And in another way, it's like adult work. They have all of the social complexity and the ability to fall out and quarrel and make up again and have complicated relationships with one another that adults do. And so you have the social complexity of adults and the demandingness of children. Youth work is not an easy area. Now, I just want to talk on this tape about four areas which I think complicate the whole thing, four factors which come into the picture and make it more difficult to decide how we should teach young people, things we have to bear in mind. And then I want to briefly mention five emphases that I think should be there in our teaching of young people. I'm only talking about emphases and things to be borne in mind because I think this is perhaps the most important thing I'll say on this tape, I don't think there is any structural solution to the problems of youth work. In other words, there is no one guide to how to do it, no one structure that works. You can go around the country and look at youth works that are being effective and analyse them, and you'll find an amazing diversity of pattern. Because God tends to start with a man or a woman, and their abilities and gifts, and their natural ways of working, rather than with one mould which suits everybody. And so I tend to distrust those books that give you gimmicks and methods and surefire techniques and routines that can't fail and 50 guaranteed ways of keeping teenagers quiet and so on and so forth, because none of them work in every situation. What's more important is to find the structure that suits you and the way in which God has planned for you to work and to be natural within that framework. But within that, I think bearing in mind some of the emphases we're going to mention may just help. Okay, so what are these four factors I mentioned which complicate the picture where youth work is concerned today? The first one is the existence of youth culture. Let's face it, we're living in a culture which places a tremendous emphasis on youth and on being young. Since the end of the Second World War, when some very shrewd manufacturers realised that young people were the only class in society who had a lot of money to spend and nothing too much to spend it on, we've had the development of teenage music and teenage films and teenage fashions and teenage styles and teenage this and teenage that, and the whole idea that it's great to be young, it's tremendous to be a teenager, come alive, you're in the Pepsi generation, that kind of emphasis that so many of us grew up with. And as a result, young people have been accorded a tremendous amount of respect and importance by society. And that's something we've had to live with and grow to get used to. It can have all sorts of impacts on our work if we're not careful. There are many churches in which young people are treated as if they're some kind of special class by themselves, the most important people in the church. Now that's unbiblical. The Bible stresses that God is the God of all age groups, not just of teenagers. And teenagers count with God, certainly. And they matter to God, but they're not the only important ones they are. And I get fed up sometimes hearing people saying in churches, you know, these young people have so much to teach us. These young people are precious to us because they are the future of this church. Of course they are, but so is everybody else. Teenagers should not be given an importance beyond what the Bible says they deserve. On the other hand, it's easy to try to join in where you can't beat them and become some kind of superannuated teenager yourself. One of the problems with youth culture is that because people have felt it's so important to be young and to stay young, lots of adults are now trying to get in on the act, to be the oldest swinger in town, as it were. And there are lots of sociologists who are now saying there really is no youth culture anymore because everybody's trying to do it. Old people are listening to the same records, copying the same styles, going to the same places that teenagers make popular. A teenage fashion can't be teenage for 5 minutes before the oldies are all copying it. And therefore, there is no youth culture anymore because everybody wants to copy it. Tony Tyler, who was assistant editor of the New Musical Express, once made this observation. I think one of the things to lament, perhaps, about the teen boom of the 50s through the 70s is that it force-fed a couple of generations with false expectations. It made them seem more important to themselves than they really are. A great deal of the angst that kids have today is because they know the respect and adulation that their elder brothers and sisters got. Even their parents, if they've got young parents. And it seems unfair to them that they don't get the same. And so less and less now is it appearing to kids a wonderful thing to be a teenager. Youth culture seems to be receding a little bit. And therefore teenagers are asking themselves more and more, well, who are we? What are we? And there's more of a stress now, not on enjoying being a teenager, but on growing up to be an adult. And this is something we have to reckon with. Youth culture has complicated the whole picture. It's thrown a spotlight on teenagers, made them feel special, and now it's in the process of taking the spotlight away again. And that's going to affect the way we teach them. Second thing that's important to remember when you're teaching young people is that our society has the longest period of adolescence, perhaps in the history of the world. James Dobson makes that point very clearly in his book Hide or Seek, which is about some of the stresses that young people go through, and I very highly recommend it to you. In some societies, there is no adolescence. You're a child one day, and then the elders of the tribe drag you off into the forest and put you through some sort of initiation ritual, and the next morning, there you are, you're an adult. Issued with a spear, sent out to hunt pigs with the men, no longer playing in the children's compound. You were a child, now you're an adult. In Roman society, the same kind of thing used to happen when our Lord was growing up. Up until the age of the bar mitzvah, the Jewish youth was treated as a child. After that, he was almost an adult. I say almost an adult because there was a period between 14 and 21 when you were recognized as being in a sort of in-between stage. But that was really kind of probationary adulthood. To all intents and purposes, you became an adult overnight at your bar mitzvah ceremony. Now, we have given people no clear age at which they become adults. They do different things at different ages. 16, you can get married if your mum doesn't mind. 18, you can get married even if she does. At 17, you can drive a car. At 21, you can become king or queen, but only at 25 can you get hypnotized in public. And so it goes on. There are all sorts of different age groups for doing different things. And so teenagers get all of these different confusing messages coming at them and say, now, when am I actually an adult? When am I grown? And that has an impact on the way that they relate to life. It means that adolescence is the time when young people are very much forming their identity, when they're in a no man's land between childhood and adulthood, and they're trying to sort out who they really are and where they're really going. That accounts for part of their openness to the gospel and their willingness to relate to somebody who's prepared to give them an adult role model, a picture of what they can be like in 10 or 15 years, a living example of satisfied, successful adulthood. And a Christian youth leader who's prepared to share his or her life with the young people in his or her control can have a tremendous impact here. It also means that young people will be very volatile. Because they're unsure of their identity, they can be very false, very hypocritical. They're trying things on for size, trying on different styles, trying on different ways of being themselves to see which one works. And therefore, you'll find that they swing about from one emotional extreme to the other. Some days they impress you with their maturity. They come out with insights which make you think, I'm really getting somewhere here. These kids are turning into adults. This is tremendous at their age too. And the next day they're acting like kids and behaving very, very stupidly and childishly. And you think, oh dear me, we haven't even started with this bunch yet. And then the next day they're back to the maturity bit, and so on and so forth. And one of the delights and fascinations and puzzles and torments of working with young people is that they are in this kind of limbo between childhood and adulthood, and you never know quite what to expect yet. Next. The third factor, youth culture, the length of adolescence and the impact that has on the kids you're trying to teach. The third factor is the family. As a youth leader, you're in a pretty artificial position, aren't you? You're trying to deal with young people who do not belong to your family in a parent kind of a way. You're in loco parentis, as far as they're concerned. In the Old Testament, the few references that we have to the education and upbringing of youth in the ways of the Lord seem to imply that it will all be done within the family. Family life was structured in such a way that it was natural for young people as they grew up to learn from their parents by asking questions. God built into Israelite family life ceremonies and rituals and practices and ways of going about things which made the children occasionally stop and ask their parents, why are we doing this? Why has God commanded this? And so the Old Testament says, when they say this to you, then say to them. And that was the context in which teaching was done, in the context of a life which provoked questions. And if we want to teach young people, actually getting them to ask questions is much more important than getting them to listen to answers. When people are provoked to question and ask and investigate, They'll learn what they hear much more readily than if we tell them before they're ready. No Israelite father sat his children down in a row and said, right, kids, now I'm going to tell you all about the Passover. Right, now I'm going to tell you all about the covenant. This is what I want to tell you about the Holy of Holies. Instead, he waited for the questions, and when the children asked, then he was to say whatever it was. And that gives us an important insight, I think, into the way that we are to help young people grow up. We have to live our lives in front of them in such a way that they will naturally ask questions. Our life has to be so distinctive from other lives around us that it naturally makes them notice the difference and ask. But it doesn't take away from the fact that the Old Testament is talking about parents, and we are not their parents. We are in a kind of subsidiary, volunteered position, and that makes it especially tricky when we're dealing with the children of non-Christian parents. Somebody once said, and I think it's absolutely true, that the first duty of children from non-Christian families is not to evangelize their parents, but to honor their parents. And unless our youth work is supporting that family structure and helping them to live out Jesus in front of their father and mother, then we are not really doing our youth work properly. Too much youth work drives a wedge between the family and the gospel. And when we do that, we'll probably keep the young people for a while, but in the end, the blood ties will call them back and they may renounce their Christianity simply because we have made their family life false, artificial, and unbiblical. Families are a complicated area in Britain today simply because the family is in crisis. We know that. The increase of new household formation amongst young people, the rising numbers of one-parent families, the incidence of violence in the family, battered wives, molested children, and so on and so forth, it all shows us that the family is having problems. Now, in a situation like that, some families fall apart and others draw together. A survey a couple of years ago called Young People in the 80s found that, and I quote, parents are now a primary source of advice about personal as well as more general problems for young people. They also provide models for the young in respect of adulthood and adult responsibilities. John Nicholson, another researcher, has suggested in his book that there is closer agreement on the really important issues between today's teenagers and their parents than between the parents and their parents. In other words, the generations are not drawing apart, they're drawing together. And there's liable to be a closer relationship between the teenager and his mum and dad today than there was 20 years ago. And that's an interesting insight, because it runs counter to everything that's been said by sociologists for a long time. And it can create problems for those outside the family who have the job of influencing the young, like the Bible class leader or the youth leader. Anybody who's involved in teaching in a secondary school today knows how much more unreasonable and unsupportive parents have frequently become. Teachers can't count on support from the home as once they could. If they fall out with a kid in their class at school, the parents surround like a shot and much more likely to take the child's side than the teacher's. There's no instruction from the home to stick in at school and do what your teacher tells you, and if he belts you, well, that's just what you deserved, man. Like, the teacher knows best. Now the pupils find their parents standing up for them. And when it's a church that's influencing the child rather than a school, the parent can become even more protective and suspicious. In society today, religions become more and more privatised. People hug their beliefs to themselves. When the Jehovah's Witness appears on the doorstep, you say, oh, I've got my own religion, thank you. Religion, to many people, is a private affair, and they don't like people poking into their business and uncomfortably questioning their beliefs. And so there's a growing general feeling that a person's beliefs are his own concern, and his life mustn't be interfered with by his church. And you can see how parents are sometimes going to get a little bit restive when youth leaders start having a large impact on their young people. There are all sorts of problems you can run up against. The problem of the young person from a Christian home whose understanding of Christian discipleship has been conditioned and narrowed by his family experience, and who's got difficulty in distinguishing his own experience of God from his father's. There's the problem of the youth worker that finds himself becoming a substitute parent. The problem of the young Christian who finds his non-Christian home the most difficult place in which to live as a Christian, much more difficult than school or the youth club or anywhere else. And the problem of the spurious conversion, when a young people young person becomes a Christian, not really because of any commitment to Jesus, but just as an emotional way of saying, I reject my home and all its values. I'm choosing your values instead. And those all show that we're likely to have tremendous problems with the family over the next few years as we try to teach teenagers. The Evangelical Alliance did a survey of Christian conversion in Britain in 1968, and although it's 20 years ago, there hasn't been one like it since. And that survey demonstrated that more than 50% of teenagers coming to faith are from a Christian home. It suggests two things to me as a youth leader. First, if that's the case, we have a particular responsibility to those born within Christian families. Second, though, it also suggests that we're not doing particularly well with teenagers from non-Christian families. So, the family's another area where you're liable to have problems in your teaching of young people, and you need to think through your attitude towards family difficulties and family ties before you start. You need to have a well-developed theology of the family so that you know exactly what you're going to do with the problems you run up against. Otherwise, they're going to come on you before you're prepared for them. Fourth area that creates difficulties for youth leaders today, and I hope I haven't put you off youth leadership already, is the church. Tying people into the church. You see, there are lots of youth groups which are very successful for a while in bringing people along on a Sunday or a weeknight evening, subjecting them to teenage whiz-bang activities and making them feel part of a large and lively group, which never actually lead into church membership. And that's been one of the problems of youth work of the last 20 years. There have often been people who've been touched by the gospel, who have gone into adult life and left it behind. And as a result, we now have a major problem with young adults in this country who are lapsed, who have made some sort of Christian commitment at some stage in their Bible class, at camp, through the witness of a Sunday school teacher or something like that, but who have never integrated themselves into a church and have gradually distanced themselves more and more from Christianity. It's quite fascinating, as family services become the rage all around the country, to find that many of the young parents who are now coming along to family services and bringing their kids are those who once were under Christian influence themselves, and maybe had some experience of the grace of God, but never became incorporated into a church fellowship, and have wandered away for years. Maybe we'll get them back, maybe not. At any rate, it can be a problem that there is a dropout rate because we are not integrating people into the church as we should. And it's all too easy to run your youth work in a way which is successful as long as the kids are young, but does not really involve them with adults in the church to such an extent they start accepting the authority of the church over their lives, identifying with the older people there, and feeling part of something which is not just teenage. You see, it's easy for teenagers to associate with their own peer group, and they, more than any other class in society, are sensitive to what their own age group think of them. They're ultra-sensitive to peer group pressure. But in the church, they need to learn to respect and live with and learn from and appreciate and minister to people of every age group. And one of the most seriously maturing things we can do for teenagers as they grow up in our midst is to expose them to a whole range of age groups within the church from whom they can learn and whom they can begin to appreciate if they start to appreciate community in Christ through the youth work that we put them through. Then the chance is that they will become naturally integrated into the church. If, on the other hand, we keep them hermetically sealed in the youth group with their own activities, never really coming into contact with the rest of the church, at most getting half-hearted invitations along to services at which they sit dutifully on rows and don't talk to anybody older than 20, they're not really meeting the church at all. In fact, they are meeting the church and getting the message, we are not interested in you, you are not old enough yet. I get annoyed when people say that young people are the church of tomorrow. They're not. If they're Christians, they're part of the church of today as well. And as Christians, they have spiritual gifts given to them by God, Perhaps gifts which need maturing and need developing and need deploying and bringing out and challenging and strengthening and teaching and all sorts of things. But nonetheless, gifts which can minister to the others in the church. And if they are not being challenged to use those gifts in one way or another, if they're not being given something they can do within the church, then the church is likely to lose them, and it will be its own fault. So, there are four pressures upon youth work: the pressure of youth culture, the pressure of adolescence, the pressure of family, the pressure of church. Now, how about those five emphases which I said we ought to remember in our youth work? I'm just going to go through those now, and that will conclude the tape. So this might be a good point, if you've already had a lot to take on board, to stop the tape, think, make a cup of coffee, and then start again. Okay, let's talk about these five emphases. The first thing I want to say is this: we should be thinking in terms of discipling rather than in terms of evangelism. Now, what do I mean by that? Basically, that bringing young people to Christ is a job which is going to take a time. It's not something you can do immediately. And because young people are in this fluctuating state where they don't really know themselves and they're just discovering their own identity, it is very difficult to make, to force them into making lasting decisions for life in a moment of time. And we can easily hang labels around their neck that don't belong there. It's all too easy to think of your youth group as divided into two categories: the saved and the unsaved, the sheep and the goats, those who have made a decision of some kind and those who have not. But that can be premature, as any youth leader very well knows. It's possible to classify people as saved because they walked forward one night at a big meeting when they were emotionally in turmoil, and somebody is unsaved because he's made no outward sign of commitment as yet, where in actual fact, in heaven's perspective, the opposite is true. The kid who got emotionally churned up enough to make some kind of outward sign has not really been touched by the grace of God. It's just that his feelings were in a twist. And the kid who's made no outward sign yet has got there quietly, may not even realise it himself yet, but is going over the next few months and even years to start showing, slowly, almost reluctantly, evidences of the grace of God in his life. One of the best books I think ever written in Britain on Christian youth work is a book called just that, Christian Youth Work, by Mark Ashton, published by Kingsway. And again, I very much recommend it to you. Here's a sample of the kind of thing he said on this issue. We'll need to help our young people constantly to update their faith, to find appropriate expression for it as their own stage of life changes. We'll be cautious to respect their vulnerability to emotional pressure. The big event and the large crowd can communicate a message that its organisers never intended. The 14-year-old girl whose first steady relationship with a boyfriend has just ended may be making a completely genuine response to the offer of the friendship of Jesus, but the wise youth worker will take it with a pinch of gently loving salt. He will try to guard her against making a drastic commitment that was never genuine in the first place, and from which she can only later extricate herself by abandoning all contact with the Christian faith. You know what happens, don't you? On the last night at camp, in an emotional appeal, a young girl becomes impressed to seek counselling afterwards, and there, with tears of repentance and contrition, she accepts Jesus Christ into her heart, only half realising what she's doing. And then she goes home, and she's counted off as one of the saved. And she wakes up on Monday morning and thinks, what went on there? It all seems so unreal, it's so far away. It was a different atmosphere, a different environment. Here I am back at home, what does it mean now? And she can't remember why she did it or what she did, and she panics. And because she cannot handle the emotional embarrassment that she now feels, she even stops going to the Bible class. She can't do it anymore. Her only impulse in the panic she feels is to withdraw from everything. Or often, at the end of a coffee bar or a concert, young people are invited to come into the counselling room, and some of them do, and they're pressed to accept Christ, and some of them do. And they're told that there is a youth meeting the following Tuesday, and they should turn up at that, and then there'll be a little bit of instruction in the Christian faith for them. And they never turn up. Why? Because they've gone away, and once they're back in their own environment again, they've thought, What was that all about? What happened to me? Was it real? Wasn't it? And because the panic sets in, they're too embarrassed to go back. And we're confused because we thought they were really converted and all of a sudden they're not showing up anymore. What's going on? And the answer is very simply, we've pushed them too far too soon. We haven't given time for a discipling process. We've been so concerned with another scalp. And so Mark Ashton says, it must be recognised that the conversion of a young person is not just an individual crisis, a personal decision on a particular evening at a particular meeting. It also has a gradual and a corporate dimension to it. Some youth workers like to think in terms of a 4-year conversion, an extended process in the life of a young person in which he comes from darkness to light. At some point, perhaps at the beginning, perhaps at the end, God regenerates that person. We have no infallible insight into when that may be in any individual case. At some point, the young person himself professes conversion. That may or may not coincide with God's work of regeneration, but along the way, these things happen. It is the task of the youth leader to care prayerfully for the young person through all those years. In one sense, the call to conversion never ends in the life of the believer. The Holy Spirit will continue to lay claim to fresh areas of our life throughout our earthly pilgrimage. In another sense, there's only one moment in which each individual passes from death to life as God, through His Spirit, enters our hearts. It's more helpful to young people to view conversion in the light of this gradual process than to put too much emphasis on the crisis decision. The challenge to decide must be faithfully made. The cross demands that. But we must be reluctant to hang saved or unsaved labels too hastily around our young people's necks. It is sometimes easier and more helpful to ask the question, is he or she spiritually hungry? Or which way is he or she facing at the moment? Than to ask the question, is he or she saved? We're desperate for the answer to the latter question, and rightly so. But God does not always trust us with it. And so we need to see bringing young people to Christ as an ongoing discipling job, something which may take a period, something which is certainly not complete the moment someone repents and accepts Christ, but something which will take a period of formation as Christ slowly begins to be seen in that young person's life through an ongoing process of discipling. It's easy for us not to use every area of young people's personalities in the discipling process. Something I often say when I'm teaching about discipling is that we have three areas in our personality: mind, will, and emotions, and all three need to be involved in following Jesus. It's easy for us not to use every area of young people's personalities in the discipling process. Something I often say when I'm teaching about discipling is that we have three areas in our personality: mind, will, and emotions, and all three need to be involved in following Jesus. And I think that very often we involve emotions and then try to involve mind and forget too much about will, which is why we sometimes end up with passengers in our churches. It's easy to work at the level of the emotions and bring about an emotional response to the gospel, and then to move on to the level of the mind and say, right, now you've made your commitment, now learn this and this and this and this. It's much more difficult to work at the level of the will and say, now this is how you are supposed to live. But really teaching young people responsibly demands that. Teaching them to live, and they only do that, they only learn that by watching us and how we live over a period. We communicate far more by our lives than we do by just our words. And we'll say more about that in a moment. Just a quote from Donald Bosch, a South African theologian who has written a lot about the theology of conversion. He says this: much current evangelism, in effect, fosters pious egocentrism. It turns out people who are egocentric but pious with it. On the one hand, he says, it operates within the orbit of the narcissistic pursuit of a fulfilled personhood. Come to Jesus and your life will be fulfilled. Thus, the church to which the new convert comes is expected to fulfil the role of a social agency for the relief of painful disappointments. Come to Jesus and have a satisfied life. On the other hand, evangelism operates as an insurance policy. It offers a safe passage to the next life with a minimum of hazards en route, because God will take care of you, won't he? It fosters a self-centred and self-serving mindset among church members. And so people who have come to Christ because of the consumer benefits, a ticket to heaven, guidance through life, satisfaction, fulfilment, and all of those kinds of things, and have never really been presented with the challenge of Christian living and the need to serve Christ through thick and thin, are not going to turn into revolutionaries for him. They're going to be passengers filling pews. Now, on the one hand, many young people will not respond to this comfortable kind of message anyway. They want a challenge, something to stretch them, not a haven to retreat from life into. And for another thing, those who do respond aren't exactly going to be world beaters when they do. And so you breed sterile, self-satisfied churches, and the whole idea of mission just peters out. I've been interested this week by how many youth leaders in Ayrshire have been saying to me, "Oh, my main problem in my church is that the young people are just passengers. They don't seem to have any spark, any initiative, any real desire to serve the Lord." You only teach people that over a period. And you don't do it by teaching them in half-hour epilogues at the end of meetings. You do it by modelling a Christian lifestyle in a committed way in front of them. Because people will always take the easy option. Jay Kessler, who was president of Youth for Christ in America, records that in the 1950s, when they started realising that they were attracting a lot of Christian kids but no outsiders, and when they started challenging those Christian kids to reach those outside it, all of a sudden the Christian kids weren't coming back to Youth for Christ. And Kessler says, they began then to join church discipleship groups where they could learn the deeper things about God. They preferred the preening of their spiritual feathers to the challenge of evangelism, if evangelism meant crossing barriers. And there are lots of kids in our churches who have become converted through a come to Jesus and you will be happy kind of evangelism, who do not see any need to be anything other than passengers for the rest of their lives, simply because they do not see modelled in us any other style. Now, that's the second emphasis. I've almost said enough about it without mentioning it. The second thing I want to say is that we should think in terms of life teaching rather than intellectual communication. Teaching kids the things they need to know to become mature Christian adults isn't just a matter of the mind. It isn't just a matter of putting doctrine into their lives, important as that may be. It's a matter of showing them how to live as a Christian. And here very often we're at fault. One of my friends used to say that you can give an incredibly well-prepared and detailed and effective Bible study at the YPF on what a Christian's attitude to the law ought to be, and then blow the whole thing by the way you drive the kids home afterwards. Your life speaks louder than your words. And we need to remember that it's a life-on-life process that teaches young people. Now, many people listening to this tape will start to feel threatened at this point, because I know that many youth leaders are the most busy people in the church. Those who get involved with the young people are normally also the kind of suckers who get stuck for everything else that needs to happen as well. And you might be saying, well, I've got no time to do this kind of thing. How can I take more time out of my diary to be with young people? It's impossible. Do you know what my diary looks like? What I think we ought to be doing, rather than just making time to be with young people in special new ways, is involving them in the natural processes of our life. So you're going to wallpaper the front room. Get one of them around to help you. Get them to help you mow the lawn. Get them to go with you whenever you're going to something from which they might conceivably learn, even if they're just carrying your bag or whatever it happens to be with you. Because it's in those unstructured, non-teaching kind of situations that often the best work is done. How often is it the case that at a camp where you have prepared epilogue after epilogue as effectively as you can, nothing of that makes much of an impact on a young person. But then one night, when you're both walking back in the moonlight along the beach, he'll suddenly shyly ask you a question. And the ensuing 10 minutes of conversation will do him far more good and catapult him several miles further forward spiritually than everything you've said in the formal sessions. Life on life is what it's all about. Then the third emphasis. Think in terms of the group rather than just the individual. Young people, as we've already said, are very open to peer pressure, very conscious of what other young people are thinking and doing around them. And Larry Richards, who's written some good things about youth work in America, and some of his books occasionally filter across here, published by Zondervan, Larry Richards has said, any Christian youth work which does not build towards a strong Christian peer group is destined to failure. In other words, if you're trying just to work with one teenager or a couple of teenagers and build them up strong in their faith, you're almost certain to fail unless you're building around them a group. Teenagers gain a lot of support from one another. That's why we have youth groups in the first place. And when you have others who think like you and act like you and are heading in the same direction, then together you can form a little group which erects a kind of lifestyle in the face of the non-Christian world outside, which you're able to maintain because you support one another. One teenager on his own up against a godless high school, or up against a bunch of people at work who have got no conception of the way in which he's thinking about spending his money and using his time, is almost certain to crack under the pressure unless he's supported by a group of people who are like himself, who are able to reinforce his attitudes by the fact that they're living them out themselves and praying for him and sharing with him and making discoveries with him together. So think in terms of the group rather than the individual, because the group can build itself and support itself. And within your group, you'll find there are people who are key people, we'll say more about them in a moment, who are able to influence and help the others, who become catalysts for the whole group. If one young person on his own goes away to a big convention or a conference of some kind, he may come back having learnt some things which will be useful to him. He may also try to explain them to the rest of the group, and because he's not very good at vocalising them or articulating them, he won't get through and the rest of them won't understand what he's on about. But if you send the whole group away together, or even better, if you go away with them and you're able to go through the experience with them too, then the whole group will learn lessons from the thing, and they'll be able to help and reinforce and support one another. Think in terms of the group rather than just the individual. And the fourth emphasis, very simply, is this. Think in terms of their needs rather than your satisfaction. I've included this one because there are lots of us who are in youth work for precisely the wrong reasons. We're youth workers because it satisfies an emotional need in us. I have to recognise that one of the reasons that I was attracted to youth work in the first place was that growing up in the kind of Scottish assembly atmosphere I did, I've always felt that a lot of teenage life was passing me by. There were so many things I wasn't allowed to do, so many places I couldn't go with people my age group, so many things that made me feel strange and out on a limb and slightly freaky. It always felt to me as if people out there were enjoying things which, as far as I could see, were okay, and which I was, just by an accident of birth, missing out on. And as a result, I suppose, I've always felt a kind of psychological need to get back in there and live my teenage years through again properly. And so I feel attracted to the company of teenagers. Teenage pursuits fascinate me and interest me, and I feel good when teenagers accept me and make me part of their circle. A lot of youth workers would make the same kind of confession. But I have got to recognise that that is there in me, and that's a psychological weakness in me, maybe a weakness that God is using, but nonetheless it's a weakness, and I must not let that dominate the way in which I work with young people. I mustn't be so concerned about acceptance from them that I do ridiculous things to get myself accepted, and therefore the gospel suffers as a result. I've got to be prepared for the fact that in the kind of youth work I'm doing, I won't always get the kind of satisfactions that psychologically I'm looking for. I do a lot of schools work, for instance, with a guy who is a musician. Now, I'm not a musician, at least I used to pretend I was, but I'm not really. He's absolutely brilliant. He's also much more witty and intelligent and good-looking than I am. And he's the one that all the girls flock to at the end of the evening for his autograph. And often, you know, I'm winding up the cables while he's signing all the autographs. And you start to think, well, what are you in youth work for? I mean, after all, they're just ignoring you. You're just the guy that comes on at the end and preaches, and then everybody goes home and ignores you anyhow. And I have to realise that that feeling is put there by the kind of psychological weakness in me, which makes me want to be recognised and important and big in a youth community. And I have to reckon that that's one of the prices I have got to pay for being in youth work anyway, that sometimes my own psychological needs will not be satisfied. But I'm in youth work not just because of those psychological needs. I'm in youth work because God has called me there and wants me to be used there. Now, what I'm saying is this, you see, that it's possible for us as youth workers to have a hidden agenda, things that we want to get out of youth work. And if those things are there, then they're there and they need to be recognised. But once they start to dominate us, our usefulness as youth workers is over. There are those people who are leading youth groups who are there because they can't face the fact they're getting old and they're trying to turn themselves back into teenagers. There are those who are leading youth groups because nobody made them an elder. And they want power in some sphere, so if the youth group is the only sphere in which they can get power, they'll take that as second best. There are those who are in youth work because they're male and they're inveterate flirts, and it's a good way to meet a lot of young girls. There are those who are in youth work because they have a chip on their shoulder about their church, and the youth group is a useful sounding board on which they can take out all of their frustrations against their own church. There are those who are in youth work because, believe it or not, they are scared of young people. I used to work for an organisation called Youth for Christ. And one thing I became aware of all over the country was that there are people on Youth for Christ committees organising youth events every month, coffee bars and schools weeks and things like that, as a salt to their conscience. The thing is, by sitting on a committee and making the arrangements and organising and running around putting up posters and things like that, they made themselves so busy in youth work that they never actually had to meet any young people. And therefore, their conscience was satisfied because they were doing something for the young people, but they weren't investing any time or any emotional depth or any kind of personal warmth in getting to know young people and working with them on a one-to-one basis. And you can be in youth work for all sorts of wrong reasons to fulfill your own needs. And if you are, one thing that's clear is that the kids will realise it very quickly. Kids hate hypocrisy, and that's not because they're outstandingly honest themselves. Kids are probably more hypocritical than adults. But because they are conscious of so much shallowness and so much pretense in their own lives, as they try on different lifestyles and try to decide what sort of adult they're going to become, they hate insincerity in adults. And they want adult leaders who first and foremost ring true right through, who are happy with being what they are, who can accept themselves as people, who are happy with what God is doing with their lives, who have given themselves totally to Jesus Christ and have no regrets about that fact. And if you are that sort of person, I believe you can be useful in youth work no matter what age group you are. There are lots of people who think their usefulness in youth work is over simply because they've reached a certain age. I don't believe your age matters to young people. I don't think they give it a second thought if they're happy with you as a person. The important thing is to be yourself. You can't turn yourself back into something you're not. And nothing makes a young person's flesh creep more than the kind of adult youth leader who's constantly trying to pour himself into jeans that are three sizes too small, brush his hair strategically so that it looks roughly like a teenage haircut and hides the fact he's got a balding patch in the middle, wears his shirt sort of open to the waist and a gold medallion round his neck the way that kids used to 5 years ago, and generally tries to turn himself into something he's not. Don't be false. I've known youth leaders of all sorts of ages who have been successful because the kids looked at them and thought, this is the kind of person I want to be in 50 years' time, in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, whatever. Perhaps they didn't want to look like that physically. Perhaps they hoped they'd keep their looks a bit better. Perhaps they didn't want all of the emphasis and ideas that the older person had. But they saw something there which represented adult maturity, success and satisfaction in happy living with Jesus Christ at the centre and that attracted them. So think of their needs rather than your satisfaction, because the kind of adult who's successful in youth work is the one whose own needs are in the background and who's free from concerns with himself just to concentrate on serving the kids. Then there's the final emphasis, and it's this. We ought to think in terms of priority people rather than maximum numbers. What do I mean by that? Again, something very, very simple indeed. Youth work is work with people who can be quite suggestible. People who can be easily manipulated. People who can be emotionally stirred. And therefore, it's not all that difficult, if you have a fairly flamboyant personality and one or two good gimmicks, to get a lot of young people together. I used to find, to my amazement, when I was part of a Christian music group going into a school, that just by playing a guitar and making loud noises, you can put together a lunchtime concert of 300 plus without any advance advertisement. You just set up the amplifiers and they all come running. And you can play to thousands of young people in a week, simply because young people will flock to your banner if they're interested in what you're doing. But the thing is, that can tempt us very often to do a superficial job with the mass rather than a costly, deep job with the few. And if you think of the way in which Jesus trained his disciples, you see that he did not deal with the mass. Oh, he dealt with large crowds from time to time, more rarely than we sometimes imagine. But within the large crowd, he had selected about 120 who were his close disciples. Within the 120, there was the 12. Even within the 12, James and Peter and John seemed to have had a closer relationship to him than the rest. And perhaps even within that group, there was the disciple whom Jesus loved, who got closest in yet. Jesus, in one way, was ruthlessly selective in the men he worked with. The Son of God had 3 years of teaching in which to get his message across to the world, in which to leave an indelible impact on human history. And the temptation to go and talk to the crowds must have been absolutely immense. After all, that was the line the devil took, wasn't it? During the temptation in the wilderness. If you just do this, Jesus, millions of people will notice. Lots of people will flock to your banner. Look at all the kingdoms of the world. I can give these to you. All of these can be yours. You can influence the masses. And Jesus went for the few. And he built into the lives of a few people so strongly and so eternally that after he was gone and when the Holy Spirit had come, they were able to take his message to the uttermost ends of the earth. Now, I believe that the way in which the Son of God discipled people gives us a model today. I think that if you really count up the number of people whom you have seriously influenced over the last 10 years, you won't be able to name more than two or three into whose lives you have built something very, very deep and important. And therefore, I think when we have a youth group, we have to be looking around the youth group for those into whose lives we can put most. Those who will be the core group from which everything else flows. The ones to whom we can teach more than we can teach the others. The ones who will be the catalysts through whom we will be teaching the others. The ones who are the leaders of the future. So many youth groups die out because the leader is a good but individual sort of character who builds the youth work in his own style and makes himself indispensable to it and then is taken away out of the situation. And because he's built nothing for the future, the whole youth work just dwindles into a caricature of itself and eventually dies out. We shouldn't be doing that. God will have planted within our youth group one or two people into whose lives we can pour a great deal. And those two or three people are probably the strategic people for the future of that particular group. And we need to be identifying them and consciously working with them, not playing favourites by any means. That's not the way it is. And there must never be a moment at which any member of our group does not feel free to have access to us, does not feel free to ring on our doorbell at any hour of day or night. But we have to recognise consciously that we can't just plaster on spiritual ointment thinly across a mass of people and feel that we're doing a good job. The people that we will do most with are few in number and need to be carefully selected. Well, as I've said, I haven't given any kinds of structures or methods or techniques. The way in which these principles work out in our own youth work can vary from situation to situation. There are lots of different ways of doing it. But the important thing is that whatever we do, it isn't founded just about on pragmatic gimmicks and methods at work. It's founded on emphases and principles that come straight from the scriptures and what they teach us about young people and their psychology and their ways of accepting Christ, family life and church life and what it means to be integrated into the church. And I'm convinced that some of these things we've been discussing will help us achieve a more biblical style of youth teaching and youth leadership, which will lead in the end to a reversal of the situation in perhaps your area, perhaps the whole of Scotland, as we see God working through our ministry and blessing young people who need him, so that a country of young people who know nothing about Jesus Christ start to turn back to him. God bless you in your work.